Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Closer's Inner Circle podcast, hosted by your partner in Success Radio. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my co-host, Ben Gay III, we are diving into the world of sales mastery with the gem from The Closer's Part 2. Now, these books, you've heard me say this before, and I'll say it again. These books, Parts 1 and 2, are widely known as the sales Bibles across the world. So this great quote by Ben from The Closer's pretty much explains why we're doing this podcast. No one wants to hear the truth about how the very best professional salespeople got there and stay there. But here it is. They have continued to learn. They pick up a piece here and there. They read books. They listen to tapes. They go to the seminars. They take notes. They try new ideas and discard old ones. They are constantly growing, learning, and evolving. And they've come to understand that there is absolutely no graduation day for a true professional salesperson. We've talked about that a bit, Ben, but I like to have it right there in front of me because it makes sense. So to our audience, if you are not yet familiar with The Closer's Part 2, the book delves into the nuanced, sophisticated techniques and mindset strategies used by the top master closers in the sales profession. And this week, we are back into the same chapter we've been working on for a while. We're opening the book to the chapter called And Another Thing. Love that title. And we're on page 246. Specifically, we're going to the segment titled Sell from the Audience. Last week, we covered Is It Really Real? And we invite you to revisit our previous conversations, all 8 of them. This is a very long chapter, and it is full of gems. So go back and listen to us today, and follow along as we delve into the narrative. And Ben says that this chapter, in his opinion, is worth the price of the whole book. And he should know, he wrote it. And if you miss us today, be sure to download and listen wherever you consume your favorite podcasts. You can also find us on Audible and YouTube. Good morning, Ben. It's Wednesday.
It is Wednesday. That's how I can tell it's Wednesday. I get to hear your voice.
So, and you didn't mention anything about a Southern accent. You're learning.
Yeah. Drawl.
Yeah. That's what
I always feel when I hear your voice. I feel like I'm back home again. I grew up where all the ladies sounded somewhat like you, a little less Louisiana and more Atlanta, Dallas. But it's very comforting to me. And some, you and I have talked about this privately, like my sister has a heavy Southern accent, but she talks like a New Jerseyan at high speed. So you get a Southern accent and a machine gun delivery, which makes it, I sort of pat my foot and try and get in rhythm with her so I can have some idea what she's saying. But it's very comforting.
I have Southern ears, and I've actually had to ask people rarely, please slow down. I'm catching every third word. You know what? Better yet, email me. I'll read it because I can't keep up. After a while, I'm just going, it's awful.
I tell you a cute little side note about Zig Ziglar for the newcomers. Zig and I started out together. He was 18 years older, so he'd already started, but we got into the same business on the same day in the same meeting. And both of us, for the first time, were making big money. Me, because I was 23, I'd never made big money. And Zig, because he finally got in the right place at the right time. But when I transferred to California to run the company a few years later, people would kid me, good-naturedly, but kid me about my Southern accent. So I deliberately, Gigi says she can still hear it, but I don't sound like
I hear it. Yeah. It's certain words. Kind of like me, I can hear certain words if I accidentally hear myself speak and go, ooh, okay, now I see what people are talking about.
Yeah.
But mostly it's just the odd word.
I was talking to a lady the other day about some technical thing. I forget what it was, one of our suppliers. And the company is from New Jersey. And she said about 5 words in a sentence. And I said, it says New Jersey on the screen, but where are y'all from? where are y'all really from? And I don't know if she was talking to me from her home or had gone to New Jersey from her home. But end result was she giggled and the answer was Mississippi. That's all that New Jersey thing doesn't fly after the third y'all.
No, it doesn't. And it's
but
so
anyway,
funny.
Zig and I were talking about
ahead,
it, because I was getting some heat, I was walking down the hall one day and passed William Penn Patrick, one of my mentors, and he was the owner of the company, Holiday Magic Cosmetics. And I said, "Hey," and he stopped dead in his tracks. He was from Roper, North Carolina, so he still had a little South in his mouth, but mainly trained it away. And he said, "Would you please stop with the hey?" And I said, "Why? I passed you in the hall. Hi. What do you want me to say?" He said, "Anything but hey. It makes you sound Southern and stupid." I said, "You're Southern." He said, "But I try not to sound like it." And the other one, I came off the stage one day and he said, "I'm not sure why you use the word as much as you do. But since you insist on using it, it's oriented, not orientated." And apparently it has become one of my favorite words, so I had to train that one away. But anyway, taking a little light kidding over the years, I trained much of my Southern accent away. Some people claim they can still hear it, but I'm not like I was in Atlanta for years. And then I started listening, which was a new concept for me, to other people talking about various people and so on. And when Zig's name came up, and there were a few others, when Zig's name came up, their number one favorite thing about Zig was his Southern accent.
Accent, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And
I told you how I came across him, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm
No.
like, I think
Well, if you
that,
did, I forgot it.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I think when I first bought this house, and I bought this house and oh, geez, well, between Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and we've got hurricane season coming up real quick here, but I was garage sailing and my car didn't need me to go to the garage sales. It knew where to go. I'm telling you, it just went wherever it wanted to go.
In the horse business, that's called barn sour.
Yeah. And I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to go to the grocery store." Uh-huh. Sure you are. I came across this little garage sale probably two blocks away from me, and I pulled in. I didn't really need anything. I never need anything, but it's a garage sale. So I found this little, and I still have it, this little square white binder. It was a plastic box, basically. It wasn't a binder, but it was, when I pulled it open, it had a whole bunch of tapes, cassette tapes. I couldn't play a cassette tape, but it said, each tape said Zig Ziglar. And I didn't know what a Zig Ziglar was. So I had to go find somebody that, you know, could loan me their little boom box. And I fell instantly in love with him. Have been ever since.
He was really something and terribly effective at getting across ideas. He, and it's true of me too, in the Bengay Jimmy Rucker partnership in the early days of Holiday Magic Cosmetics, I have a tendency, since I'm still in business and Jimmy's retired, to say I won this or I did this or I did this. We did it as a team, and Jimmy was the hard-nosed closer. There were some sales I would walk away from rather than have them become unpleasant. Jimmy never did. He was to the end, to the last word, Jimmy was closing, and he usually came up with a sale. Zig had a partner named Mel Lanius, and Zig was the front man. Mel Lanius has become a trivia question to those of us in the business, but Mel was the killer closer. Zig was the charming guy from the front of the room with the funny stories, biscuits, fleas, and pump handles, among others. And everybody loved Zig. Meanwhile, over in the corner, Mel Lanius was closing the sales. So when you're listening to those tapes, if you got really effective sales material, not story material, but sales material, you were really listening to Mel Lanius and lots of other people, of course, that Zig worked with and picked up from over the years. But He was quite a guy, and I discovered that once you've given up your Southern accent, you can't get it back. Gee, like, is a movie watcher. I'm not. So if we're lying in bed, she's watching a movie. I've gone to my happy place, and occasionally in a movie they'll have a Southern, I'm putting Southern in air quotes, a Southern person in the role, and Gigi will say, "Ben," and I said, "No," because her question is going to be, "Is that a real Southern accent?" And you must hear that all the time if
Oh,
you
I
watch.
can't listen. I can't listen.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than someone who doesn't have a Southern accent and maybe has only flown over the South trying to do a Southern accent.
Oh, they're so overwrought.
Yeah.
They just, I'm like, calm it down. Just, I get mad. I just leave.
It sounds like Rooster Cogburn.
Rooster Cog. Oh, was that a John Wayne movie?
No.
I don't know who
He's
it
a
is.
cartoon character,
Oh.
and he was a rooster. And he said, "I'll tell you what, son, I'll tell you." It was sort of a blend between a good Southern accent and Amos and Andy.
Oh,
But
geez.
he was a and somebody, oh, Yosemite Sam. He was sort of a rooster version of Yosemite Sam, who also had a pretty, but those were all Mel Blanc, and Mel could do any accent he wanted and any voice he wanted. He also was an amazing person. But anyway, Zig was a great guy, and the Southern accent was real, and whoever told me to lose my Southern accent did me a big disservice. So I'll drop in a Oh, y'all. Well, I say y'all naturally, because that's a proper word in my dictionary. But occasionally I'll drop in something if I want to get somebody's head to turn, and I consider a success if they say, "Where are you from?"
Right. I told you one of my favorite Southern things, jeet yet.
Oh, did you eat yet? Yeah,
Yeah, it's
yeah.
three words. Did you eat yet? It's jeet yet with a question mark. Everybody around here says, no, what you got? They might have just came from a drive-through window, but if you're offering, they're going to eat it.
Sure, you have to. It would be impolite not to. And there is a tendency for Southerners to have a little extra weight on them, especially the men. I have several friends, oddly enough, who own barbecue joints, and they're always sending me pictures of their happy customers and so on. And there's one common denominator among their customers. It's called mild obesity.
It's not the meat that's making you fat, it's all those sides.
Yeah.
Stay away from those. Eat the meat. Just leave
Yeah.
alone.
Well, I love it. Let's get into it. Let's go to
Let's
work.
go. All righty. So you start because this is a big topic. So from the audience, and I've read it a couple of times, and I went back this morning and I read it again. And you start with all of the magnificent performance I know, whether they are in show business, sales, law, or any other profession, have a special view of the world. And you tell us what it's convinced of, what convinced
Well,
you that this is true.
yeah, it's one of the major elements of their greatness. It's a skill that I was never taught anywhere. I acquired it along the way from other people in other situations, but it was never taught for me from the front of the room. A dear friend of mine, Wade Cannon, who was a psychologist, human behavioral scientist, et cetera, one of those educated people that makes you feel like maybe you should have stayed in school a little longer. He called it fourth wall perspective, and I've since found out he got that from theaters. Theater people know what fourth wall perspective is. Let me just draw the word picture really quickly. When you go to a play, there are the average person think if they think at all about it, they think there are three walls. The back wall behind in front of which the performers perform, stage or audience right, stage or audience left, the other two walls where people generally just sort of come and go. But there's usually a wall and there's a picture hanging on it or something. You're looking at a box with three walls, but there is a fourth wall, and that's where the super performers, whether they be salespeople, speakers, actors, lawyers in a courtroom presenting their case or whatever, that's where, from where they, I'm trying to avoid ending a sentence in a preposition, Winston Churchill said, that's the type of English up with which I will not put. So I was trying to avoid it. But anyway, the really good ones understand the fourth wall. The fourth wall is where the audience sits. And you can view the play. It would be hard from the wing. Well, you can from the wings, right wall, left wall. Hard from the back wall because you would be in the way of the actors. But a lot of the actors view it from that back wall also. It's, hello, me, looking out at the audience, seeing how they are reacting. And there's some real value in that. When I'm giving a speech or holding a seminar, I usually rather quickly pick out four or five sprinkled out left, right, up front, midway back, maybe all the way in the back of the room. I pick out four or five friendly faces. And although everybody thinks I'm looking at everybody, I'm focused in on those faces primarily because they're friendly and happy. And that's the reason I picked them. And I can see how the whole audience is reacting by how those people are reacting, in addition, of course, to either laughter or applause or what have you. But a real professional looks at the play from the fourth wall, even though he or she is in the play, even though he or she is giving the speech or making the presentation to the jury. Jury would be a great example of the fourth wall. There's the courtroom as everybody sees it, but a good lawyer puts himself in the jury box and watches his or her performance from there, literally from there, as if they were, he or she can see their outfit, how it looks, can see if they have any aggravating mannerisms. I think I told you I quit smoking. Not for the, and I was a three-pack a day smoker 45 years ago or whatever it was, until one day I didn't catch it live in the seminar. I should have, but I did a X number day seminar in New York, and then I came back and I was in our training room watching the video on the big screen, and I was astounded at how much time I spent. This is back in the day where almost everybody smoked. There was an ashtray in front of every chair in the audience. And if the seminar was, probably didn't smoke during the keynote speech because they're quick. But if you were doing a long seminar and you smoked, you lit up in front of the room. I was watching a Johnny Carson tape the other day and was astounded to see him. I'd forgotten, but was astounded to see him light up and smoke while interviewing somebody. That was normal in those days. And one of the ladies, I think a guest on the show, Joan Collins, who was from Dallas, the old show Dallas or something like that, she lit up and she was flicking ashes in the ashtray on his desk. And I thought, God, how times have changed. That looks weird. Well, it didn't look as weird years ago when I had this tape done of me talking in New York, until I got home and it forced me into fourth wall perspective. I wore tailor-made black suits, three-piece suits. I was brushing ashes off my black suit rather frequently. I was squinting my eyes because smoke was getting my eyes. If I put the cigarette in my mouth and went to pick up something, the smoke invariably went up in my eye. And I was just astounded at A, how stupid I looked, and B, how much time I spent dealing with a cigarette. I spent more time dealing with a cigarette than any single member in the audience. And I was watching it, and I reached into my pocket, got my cigarette pack out of my shirt pocket, wadded it up, threw it in a trash can about 5 feet away, and never smoked again. Not for health reasons, not for you're going to die of cancer, nothing other than you look stupid. Fourth wall perspective. even though I had to do it on tape, caused me to quit smoking. So back to sell from the audience. The real pros among us never lose that sight when they walk across the stage. They feel the steps in their feet, of course. They're looking at the audience, of course, but they're also about halfway back in the audience watching themselves walk across the stage. I remember one time doing something, and most of the meeting was on a script. I think I was teaching them how to deliver a script. And I was thinking about something else, and I saw from the audience my right hand go up in the air. And I said to myself, you better tune back in. This is the end of the talk. My mouth was running, but when it got to a certain point in the script, my right hand went up in a gesture. And from the audience, I thought, tune in, tune in. This is coming to an end now. You do that at the end, like I was watching a movie. And it gives you a power that most speakers, salespeople, actors, lawyers never pick up, because they're watching it from their viewpoint, not the audience. How is the audience taking this? What are they seeing versus what I'm seeing? And how can I adjust that? And I've made major adjustments right in the middle of a talk, because I realized from the audience, this wasn't having the effect I thought it would have. So oversimplified, we can discuss it more, answer questions or whatever, but oversimplified, that is for fourth wall perspective. And I give an example in there about a friend of mine, he's passed away now, who used to sell very valuable in their content and very pricey in their pricing programs on how to be successful and how to sell and so on. And his closing rate, I wrote in the book, I really don't remember it until I read it again, was about 68%. He spoke to 500 people and he sold on average, and which made up about 250 couples, because this was a couple type product. Either help the salesperson among you if you're not one of them, or how to support the salesperson, wife to husband, husband to wife, or whatever. So generally speaking, it was a high priced product that both of them had to be involved in to buy it. His closing rate was around 68%, and he made he retired wealthy. Because, among other things, he had a fourth wall perspective, to the extent, in his case, he would gather as quickly as possible while it was fresh in everybody's mind. He would gather everybody together on his staff in the hotel suite the minute they got back to the office the next morning, wherever it was, while it was still fresh on their mind, and they would dissect his performance from the fourth wall. He would tell them what he saw in his mind from the fourth wall. And, you know, then somebody in the room would say, yeah, but here's what I saw, and might bring some entirely new perspective to it. But you've got to look at it from all sides, be aware of what they're seeing, not all caught up in your presentation, or caught up in your amazing skill. Get on their side of the table. We teach that basically in selling, when we talk about get out of your chair and mentally get in their chair. They're on the other side of the table looking at you if it's a closing situation. And so you want to hear and see what they're hearing and seeing. People say, well, I can't do that while I'm concentrating on my thing. Well, then you're screwed. Because the super champions, the one who wins the trip to Hawaii and you wave as they leave to go on their trip, they've learned to master it consciously or subconsciously, which brings me to another interesting point. Some people have this skill and they don't even know what they're doing. It comes to them naturally.
I just wrote that down because you said, if you have questions, I've got questions. My hand went up in the air. How do you determine at some point, I mean, you finally, it kind of, you twigged to it that you had this ability, but can it be taught? Where could people learn this? I suspect that I do something very similar because I'm always aware. You know, I'm pivoting all the time. I may not have moved an inch, but I'm pivoting. I'm looking behind me.
Yeah.
I'm looking above me. I'm hearing God winks. I'm hearing voices in my head. But, you know, I'm always aware of what's going on. And I don't think that I ever identified that as me possibly being able to access that fourth wall.
Well, it's crucial that you do, and you probably are natural at it, but even being aware of it is a tremendous help. We're talking about the subject. I'm sitting in an office chair in front of a computer with no one else around. I just looked around to make sure there was no one else around. Didn't want to insult somebody. At the moment, I'm in my office by myself, but because we're talking about it, I'm aware of hand gestures as if you could see me, although you can't, because hand gestures and facial expressions contribute to what's coming out of your mouth. If you're talking to somebody who's in a really good mood and smiling, if only subconsciously, you can hear it on the phone, which, by the way, comes right near the end of that chapter. Fourth wall perspective does apply to the phone. Phone calls, sales presentations by phone. It even applies in emails and so on. Before I hit send on an email, and I've sent some I wish I hadn't sent, but not many, I pause. Silence and calmness, or the appearance thereof, are superpowers. I take advantage of that. Before I hit send, I try and think, okay, read it again. How are they going to receive this? Do they know about my sarcastic, sparkling sense of humor? If they don't, or it's even a little iffy, then I take it out and change it, because I don't want to send something that I feel, you know, chuckle, chuckle, this is really cute, and send it to someone who doesn't get that. All they hear is, you're a moron.
You said it wrong. It's moron.
Moron. You a moron.
Moron. You have to say it with, you know, a lot of flavor there.
Yeah. I've had to teach Jeannie that many, many words she thinks are two syllable are actually three.
There's gas is 2 to 3 syllables. It's, you know, GAS, but it's gas. So you got to do it right.
As a commercial, I'm a news junkie, so televisions near me are generally set on 24-hour news channels, if only background sound. I may not be paying strict attention, but there's a commercial that's running now, and it's a good old Southern boy, and he's had some sort of pain, and it's a commercial for a pill that you take for 2 or 3 weeks, and whatever your pain is goes away. And he says, after 2 or 3 weeks, he said, my pain was gone. And his wife said, well, who had recommended it to him, said, well, I'm glad it helped. He said, no, you don't understand me. It's gone. And he says, how do you get 2 syllables out of gone? I said, you pronounce it properly.
That's right.
Yeah.
I get all kinds of people say, I have this one friend, he'll say, Denise, what? Say barbed wire. Oh, geez. And I'll say it. And I'll hear it, and he just laughs and keeps on going. I have no idea why he's so tickled by that. It's barbed wire. Come on. Everybody knows what that stuff is. Don't stick your butt in it. It'll hurt.
And it doesn't have an ED on the end, and it's one word, and you say it fast.
That's so exactly right.
I don't see the problem. So anyway, that's fourth wall perspective. And it's something that, yes, you can teach yourself, but here's how you teach yourself. You just become aware of it. You know, if I was watching this from across the room in another chair, what would I be seeing? That's fourth wall perspective. If you're a leg shaker, you've seen those people.
Mm-hmm.
You're a leg shaker, you got to figure out a way to stop it. Makes you look stupid. And to someone who really knows about leg shaking, it labels you with all sorts of psychological problems. When I was teaching in prisons, which I did for 11 plus years at San Quentin, Lompoc, and a few others, if you went in the TV room especially, or the room where I was given the talk or holding the seminar, I had to get used to the feeling, unless it was on a solid cement slab, that that wasn't an earthquake. That was the synchronized leg shaking of 200 people, 150 of which were leg shakers. It's a common thing, denominator, that you find in prison. Now, they can be doing it for different reasons, but it's not a good sign. So if you're aware you're a leg shaker, or you look down fourth wall perspective and see your leg shaking, stop it. Just stop it. You may even go out in the parking lot later and shake it all you want, but don't do it in front of customers. A, it's distracting. They may miss something that you just said, and confused minds don't buy. Or they're like my friend Wade Cannon, human behavioral scientist. You're shaking your leg and he's going, oh, okay, psychotic, broken family. You know, he's laying all sorts of other things on it. But mainly he isn't listening to your performance, whether it's on a stage or sales presentation or what have you. So you try and wipe away those things that are distracting. Effective selling is frequently not what you do, it's what you don't do, what you get rid of. Like the sculptor who was asked, how did you see an elephant in this magnificent elephant in that big block of stone? He said, I just knocked off everything that didn't look like an elephant. And there it was. Well, in selling, you knock off everything that doesn't look like a professional, caring, attentive salesperson. Leg shaking is among them. Smoking is another.
Like picking up your cell phone. I'll be in a restaurant with friends, and I'll see people all around me. They're sitting with people, a loved one, a child, another person, a human being, and that phone is either in front of them or they're, you know, typing something on it. Ben, one day, I'm telling you, I'm going to go to jail for picking up a phone and putting it in a glass of iced tea. I know it's going to happen. I'm going to need bail money.
Yeah, as I say, lovingly to our family, anyone who wants a separate check, take out your cell phone.
Mm-hmm. I have a rule in my house. If you're here for a meal or a holiday, your phone is either off or it's in your car. Don't even try it. And they believe it. They know better, because I will say, I'm not going to even give you a to-go bag. You just forfeit it out. Go.
Well, those are the little things that take away. And your job is to remove anything from your performance. Beth seen from fourth wall perspective, remove anything from your performance that distracts them and or confuses them. Confused minds don't buy. There may be one word in your whole repertoire in this particular case. It might be one word that makes the sale. If they're thinking about something else or distracted by something at that moment, you may never know why it happened, but it happened. You want to be the center. You want them to feel they're the center of attention from you. But in reality, you want to be the center of their attention, minus anything that takes away from that. Smoking, leg shaking, cussing. It's become very popular, apparently. Even our new, not new, even our vice president dropped the F-bomb yesterday.
Yeah, that was just so sweet.
Yeah, wasn't that lovely? I know you just lost a lot of sweet Southern ladies, who, even though they may, from time to time, under the right circumstances, drop the F-bomb, they don't want to see it on international television.
No, so, and cackle about it.
Fourth wall perspective. Don't write in a book when you're on the short vice presidential list that you took your sweet little family dog out in a gravel pit and shot it.
Yeah.
Followed by a goat the same day apparently she was in a killing mood. I've spent a lot of time on farms in the South and ranches out here. I get it. I understand that ranch people have a different attitude. People from different parts of the world have a different attitude. Ben Andrew, dear friend of mine from the Caribbean, when he would come out to visit in Marin County, we had a big house. And to go with the big house, we had a big dog, a 236-pound St. Bernard, who loved Ben Andrew. And he would come over and drool all over him. We didn't have a dry mouth St. Bernard. We had a wet mouth. My wife at the time, the late Marcia Gay, would say, "Don't worry, it dries clear," which was not true.
No. And it makes your clothes stiff as a board.
Yeah.
I had a great Pyrenees, and I'm telling you, if you needed to take that dog outside and, you know, get a doggy bag, you needed a shovel and a wheelbarrow. Where'd you go? You still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
You needed a shovel and was when you got out.
Oh, wheelbarrow. Sorry.
Oh.
It was not fun.
Yeah. And you just said wheelbarrow, as a Southerner would say it.
I
so
did. I didn't
you
mean
did
to.
well that's you're in the South and you got a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
But Ben Andrew, he was a, I'm guessing, 350-pound jet black Caribbean guy from Barbados originally, and he would pat Caesar on the head because he was a polite guy and he wasn't afraid of him. And I said, "Well, you're getting where you love Caesar." He said, "Well, I love Caesar, but I don't understand why he's inside." In Barbados, chickens, roosters, big dogs, goats, they have them all, but they're out in the yard. They're not in the house drooling on guests. So you got to be aware of your situation, who you're talking to, and so on. And I know I was a young boy, then I was in the Boy Scouts, then I was in the Coast Guard, then I spent 11 years working in and around prisons. I know a few cuss words. I know some cuss words probably you've never even heard. I'm not a prude on my back deck with three or four people, men. And if I know the men, there are some stories that aren't funny without the proper word in the proper place. That's what makes them funny. So I'm not prudish, but I'm not the female vice president of the United States either. And the only, here's an example of that. The only thing I'm aware, I saw the most of her chat. She was being interviewed, saw most of it. I couldn't tell you the subject. I really don't have a clue what she was talking about. All I remember is the blinking door. That's it. Grand total, my mind went blank for the rest of the rest of her presentation, or whatever you'd call it, rest of her answer. There's an example of, if she'd been thinking, it wouldn't have come out of her mouth, because fourth wall perspective would have kicked in. And even if she had her lips formed for the F word, it wouldn't have come out. She'd have caught herself.
Well, some people aren't that aware.
Yes. Most salespeople and our vice president.
Yeah. But I wanted to go back to the fourth wall, because at some point, and I'm really fascinated by this, and I know we're going to get questions like, well, how can I find out if I have this ability? How can I learn it? And you say, where did it go? Here on page 246, I went back a little bit. At the risk of sounding spooky, these people, you know, artists, salespeople, actors, they have what some might call out-of-body experiences, and they use them productively, because in selling, we don't have the luxury of being coached by a director, producer, script girl, or a teleprompter. So you have to really kind of watch yourself. And I think the book is telling us, dissect everything you just did. You know, mm-hmm. Go back, and if you have access to any videos or any audios, pay attention. Where did you make a common mistake that you make all the time that is nothing more or less than distractive? You know, how do we teach ourselves to be more aware, I think, is my real question.
A, be aware. There is a thing, whether you've ever heard of it before, whether you believe in it or not, there's a thing called fourth wall perspective, and it is a powerful tool if A, you're aware of it, and B, you learn how to use it. And it's the sentence you just read or the paragraph. In selling, we don't have the luxury of being coached by a director, producer, script girl, or teleprompter. In spite of the fact I wrote that, we do. The trick is understanding it's you in all of those positions. It's you. So you have it, but you got to tap into it and use it. It's not just you, capital Y, capital O, capital U. It's you in many forms. It's you. I used to have a person almost made me a little lazy named Cheryl Shoemate. Second time I've said this today, he's just passed away. So I guess I'm getting that age where everybody that I know, or a large percentage of people I've known for years, are starting to go. Cheryl just went. With Cheryl, he was sort of my Ed McMahon in seminars. He worked for me in 1, 2, 3, 4 different companies, always fulfilling the same role. He enabled me to speak more bluntly than I might if I were by myself. And then he would jump up with my permission. It was part of the act, and say what Mr. Gay meant was, to soften the blow. Well, we don't all, and now I don't have either, a Cheryl Shoemate to follow me around picking up the pieces. Cheryl used to tell me one time, he said, sometimes I feel like the last man in the elephant parade, the one with the snow shovel following the...
I have a picture in my head now.
Following the big elephant, scooping it up and yelling to the audience. What he meant was, so on. So with him gone, I have to be my own Cheryl Shoemate. I can't say it to start with. When he retired a few years ago, or ceased working regularly with me, at least semi-retired, I remember the first time I was on stage, I was saying to myself, okay, Ben, Cheryl's not here. You are the director, producer, script girl, prop boy, etc. It's all on you now. He's not going to leap in and save you. So that just sort of heightened my fourth wall perspective. And I literally, the day after I did a big seminar and Cheryl wasn't there, but he knew I was doing a big seminar, he called. He said, how'd you do? And I said, well, I was Ben Gay. You know how I did. He said, no, I don't know how I did. You did. I wasn't there. And I said, well, I'll be honest with you, Cheryl. I was a little more nervous than I have been in years. Because I could no longer think to myself, it's okay, he'll step in, clean it up, and we'll march on. There was no Cheryl. It was all on me. Fourth wall perspective went into deep focus and technicolor to pay attention to what I was doing.
Well, that makes sense. And you know, I can almost hear questions now popping up in our emails like, but I don't have time to learn how to do this. I need to make sales now. I know it's going to happen.
Probably so. But it's that thing that you hear is like scripting. A lot of salespeople don't like scripts. Well, one, if they've been in selling more than 30 days, they're on a script, because we tend to say and do the same things over and over again until, like inertia, until acted upon by an outside force, like quit doing that or you're fired. That's an outside force. But you're already on a script. So we're just down to the quality of the script. Is it tested? Uh-huh. And did you have the discipline versus laziness to learn the effective presentation? When people say, I don't want to learn fourth wall perspective, I'm busy. Well, A, it doesn't take 2 minutes to understand sort of what it is. And then in 4 or 5 presentations or sales presentations, practice it, you begin to see it. So if someone says to me, and I understand, I don't understand fourth wall perspective, I said, well, get a copy of the closers, turn to page 246 and read it 10 times. You probably will when you're done. And then practice it. But see, that's where the breakdown always comes. Oh, I have to practice. I have to learn.
Yeah, I don't have time.
Yeah, I don't have time to do that. but you have plenty of time to be bad at your craft. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and reinforce that. So listen, I'm going to take a moment here to invite our audience. When you have questions about things that we're talking about, I have questions. I read this book, I don't know how many times. I have the honor to speak with Ben about it. And sometimes I'm like, what? So you are not alone. Ask us questions. Ask Ben questions, because that's why we're doing this. Okay, Ben, back to you.
I think we're done with that. We can plunge on to straight, the next section of that chapter, or whatever you want. I'm keeping an eye on the clock, because last week we ran over 15 or 20 minutes, which left you with an unbelievable editing problem, I'm sure.
No, I decided not to edit it.
Oh, okay.
I was snarky last week a little bit, just a little. And I thought, Denise, come on now. Not everybody gets your sense of humor. Well, heck with them. They're going to have to just get it. I tried. I was going to cut it out, but I thought, I listened to it and I thought it wasn't that bad. And then I listened to it again. So, no, it really wasn't that bad. Let it go. So,
fourth wall perspective is just that you did it later. The trick in fourth wall perspective is to do it while it's happening.
Well, I didn't, and I was worried. But we've still got about 15, 20 minutes. We're good. But yeah, we'll go now to page 248, straight. And you started out by saying, I had a breakthrough in selling one afternoon in Raleigh, North Carolina. Let me share it with you. So go ahead, share.
Well, I was working for a guy named George Friesen. And the way I knew him, when I was a young buyer, assistant buyer, and then buyer at Macy's, George called on me and sold me cookware and two or three other things. Contact, stick-on shelf paper, and a line of cookware and something else. And he and I struck it up, and he saw something in me that I don't think I had seen. I really didn't have a big career path in front of me. I drifted into Macy's. Here's how a career can get started. I'm standing outside Murphy High School one day, senior year. It's near Christmas time. A friend of mine who I'd known all my life comes running out. And I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going down to Macy's. They're hiring people. You want to come? And I said, sure. He was dating a girl who worked in the personnel department. I said, sure. So I went down and I'm standing there and I said, can they help you? I said, well, I'm with him. They said, well, are you looking for work? I said, sure. And so they hired me for one day to take returns back the day after Christmas, which is their second busiest day of the year. I didn't know that. And they trained me for 2 weeks to take returns back for one day, the day after Christmas. I think they trained everybody else too, or they thought I was a little slow. But in the interview with a lady named Barbara Franz, I heard her say that she was going on vacation the day after Christmas and would be gone for 2 weeks or something. And I remember her saying that. And I remember she was very pretty, older than I was, but a very pretty woman. So I was sort of fascinated by listening to her and talking to her. And after it was over, I went through the training, took returns back the day after Christmas. And I think I was still living home, and mother or dad, somebody said to me, well, what's the deal with Macy's? And I remembered she was going to be on vacation for 2 weeks. I said, oh, I'm still working at Macy's. So I got dressed, got in the car, drove downtown, went back to the housewares department and just checked in. They said, oh, you're back. I said, sure. I got hired, And they said, oh, okay. 2 weeks go by. I'm in the stock. Now I'm head of stock, one step beneath assistant buyer. And the door to the stock room opens, and there stands Ms. Franz, Barbara Franz. And I looked up, I said, oh, hi. And she said, nicely played, Mr. Gay.
And you stepped in.
Yeah. Did you enjoy your vacation? So I went from standing outside of school one day and a casual question to a friend who was running by me to the parking lot. If I'd been facing the other way, I wouldn't even seen him, to the day after Christmas returns, to 4 or 5 years at Macy's to meeting George Friesen and several other people who by then were calling on me. He saw something. So I said all that to say this. He hired me, but I didn't get off to the zippy-doo start. Everybody thought I was. I was funniest in my senior class, wittiest and this and that and first at that this. And I was the youngest buyer when I made buyer in Macy's then 100-year history. And I wasn't legally old enough to sign a purchase order. So it was happenstance to a large degree, happenstance. And now all of a sudden I'm supposed to be a superstar at selling. George Friesen realized it wasn't really happening. And he asked me one day, he said, let me ride along with you. So we went up to North Carolina and on a 4 or 5 day trip. And he was watching me work, do my little presentations. And George said, you're missing the mark here. What's the problem? I said, well, I'm afraid of asking for the order, one. And he said something to me like, was I ever afraid in asking you for the order when you were the buyer? I said, I really don't recall. He said, I wasn't. I was trying to do good things for you. I was trying to help a young man who was in over his head look good as a buyer. I gave you lots of extra help, and that's what we're supposed to do for our people. He said, let me do the next presentation and you watch. So he called on what was supposed to be my account, and he had a talk with him. He said to me, we call it straight, straight. I'll be straight with you. You be straight with me. That was the thing he set up with the buyer early in the relationship. And when you read Sales Infiltration, the last chapter in the Closers Part 2, you'll see that straight, straight had a big impact in how I work, sell, and close. It's a great way to overcome all objections up front. You get the buyer's permission for you to lay out the table, to set the table. Here's how we operate. And I'm not going to oversell you. And I'm going to try not to undersell you. I'm going to teach you things, offer things to you that I sincerely believe are in your best interest. And he went on to tell me, he said, if you oversell them, you're a con person, a con man, I suspect. He said, don't ever do that. You'll ruin my reputation and your reputation rather quickly. And if you undersell them, you're doing them a disservice. You're costing yourself money and you're doing them a disservice. Sell them properly to start with. Tell them up front, I'll be straight with you. You be straight with me. I'm going to offer you some products and services. But we also had price objections in that business, or I did. George Friesen didn't, because we sold, by and large, high-end, higher-priced items because they were worth it. And I took that, being young and stupid, I took that to mean it was an objection, a problem. So George explained how we operated. He was talking to me as much as the buyer. Went through the presentation. He closed the sale. Easy. I don't remember, you know, where that money, there wasn't a jarring moment where, oh, now he's closing. Oh, now he's thinking. It was just the logical conclusion to a pleasant conversation. And it'd be an even better story if I could tell you how much we sold or George sold the buyer. I really don't remember, but it was a pretty good size sell. I remember that. And he said, now, Ben, you've established, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not looking at the book. We've established now a relationship that you can draw on for years, right up until the day you dump garbage in the well and ruin it. And he said, do you understand that? And I probably didn't understand it, but I said that I did. But now I do understand it. If you treat the deal with them straight, straight, and then if you treat them that way and you're honest and ethical with them, you can go back to that well for years. I talked to a gentleman the other day named Chuck Bush. He's the son of Nolan Bush. Nolan Bush sat in an opportunity meeting I did 60 years ago, and I still do business with Nolan. That's that famous meeting that Rucker and I were told there'd be 500 people there, and there were two.
Right, we've
Yeah.
talked about that.
Yeah. Nolan Bush and his running buddy or business partner. Okay, well, now, 60 years later, we still do business together. In fact, we're embarking on a new venture together. And in the last few days, I've talked to his son, Chuck Bush, several times. Chuck wasn't alive when this relationship started. And now he's a customer because through all those years, we have treated each other straight, straight. That was the deal when we started. It was a promise we made to it because I'd learned it from George Friesen. You know, I walked to the front of the room in front of the two people and said, I only know the script for a huge crowd. So do you mind if I give you the script as if there were men and women here and the room was full? And I said, no, that's fine. I said, good evening. My name is Ben Gay. I'm a general distributor with Holiday Magic Cosmetics. It's my pleasure to welcome you. And went right into the 47-minute sales presentation. We had a built-in objection. You're in a room with 500 chairs in it, and there's only two of you. Something must be wrong. That would be the normal setup. But as Jacobus Edwards taught us all years ago, if you have a built-in objection, bring it up first and brag about it. Selling Rolls Royces, price is an objection. Standing in a room with 500 chairs and only two people showed up, that's an obvious objection. That's the elephant in the room. Get it out of the way. Be straight, straight with them. I even said, as I just said to you, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There was only four people in the room, Jimmy Rucker, me, and the two prospects, and we were all male. But I got permission to deliver the script the way I knew it. I wasn't big on improvising in those days or adjusting to the situation. You got the presentation. Did it work? Yes, they bought that night. Not for me. I did the meeting as a favor for Merle Fraser, another old friend, one of my early mentors. Did it as a favor for him. But I'm now 60 years later, still working with one of those two. Well, actually, both of them. I don't have interaction with his partner much because it's not needed. But yes, and I'm on the second generation, all because one night, in an awkward situation, I asked permission to be straight, straight, got permission, and march forward. So if you have a built-in objection, bring it up first and brag about it. Understand price is not a problem. What you want is you want to go from team A and team B, set up like two opposing football teams, to team C, which you formed, in which you and the prospect are co-owners, and you're co-owners of the problem, even if you had to help them create the problem or see the problem, and you're co-owners in the solution. It takes all that fear of asking for the order and selling and so on off the table. Cute story. I'm in San Francisco the other day. This is somewhat off the subject, but I must have said something that reminded me of it. I'm sitting on the edge of the bed, changing my shoes, getting ready to go to a business meeting, and the voice comes on television, and it's one of my clients, automobile salespeople. And they said, I'm paraphrasing till the last sentence, but they said, you can trust us, come on down, we got great pricing and so on. So, quote, no high pressure selling. And we have no closers. I've been training their closers for years. Well, I guess what they meant was, I hope. I don't know if that's
Hang
a
on.
Compliment. It's a compliment. Yeah. We've paid Ben Gay for years to teach us how to close, but we don't have any closers.
But, you know, I think I know what they mean by that, because years ago when I was young and stupid, would buy a brand new car instead of one that was 2 years old.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't going to lose my fanny when I drove it off of the lot. I bought my very first car, and I knew even at 18, 19 years old that the guy that came out of nowhere, he was not the person who sold me the car. He was not the person who even helped me write out all the documents that I had to write. He came out of nowhere. And I looked at him and I knew he was a closer. I didn't know the term, but I knew I didn't like it. And I was being funneled into, you know, trying to buy something else. And I left. I was so mad. I was 18, 19
Good for
years
you.
old, and even I knew I was being had. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go get my daddy. I didn't have a daddy, but I was going to go get a male and scare the bejeebers out. I just went to another dealership and watched. But that guy was a closer, no question. He was going to try to get me to add a whole bunch of crap that I didn't need.
And he'd given the salesperson had given him a signal through the
Oh,
glass or something of this isn't going well.
Yeah, well, I knew it wasn't going well. And they finally figured out from my lack of enthusiasm that it wasn't going well for them either.
That conversation about their commercial, we have no closers. The truth is, I wasn't offended at all. What they're saying is, we have closers, but you won't be able to identify them.
Exactly. And that's what I'm thinking. You know, they know what you're doing. They know, you know, straight, because I'm sure you've taught them that. But you when an obvious closer comes down a hallway with, you know, a cup of coffee in his hand and looks you right in the eye, just go. Leave. So,
They need somebody to work with them on the introduction, the
well, this
walk
is a
up.
long time ago, but I haven't forgotten about it. I was totally incensed. I thought, how stupid do they think I am? I went, well, obviously they think I'm stupid. So I just kicked my mad person and left.
Cary Grant said something I use in selling all the time. He said, the secret of acting, Cary Grant, the actor for you young people. Cary Grant said, the secret of acting was not to get caught at it. You know, you're supposed to sit there and watch the movie and not think to yourself, oh, that's Cary Grant acting as if he's Bob Schwartz reading lines on cue cards slightly out of camera range. You're supposed to think that's Bob Schwartz, and he may resemble Cary Grant, but he's not. Well, that's also the secret of selling, is don't get caught at it. If I'm having a conversation with somebody and there's a product or service involved, I'm selling. But they're not supposed to know that unless I've acknowledged it right up front. Hi, I'm a salesman. You're the prospect or the client, and you think I'm a liar, cheat, and thief, and I think that you will lie to get out of making the decision. Is that about explain it? And they will laugh and go, yeah, that's pretty much it. I said, okay, let's get that all out of the way. And then I bring up all the objections in front that are supposed to come at the back end when you're getting close to the close. And then when you get close to the end of the conversation and they do something stupid, you say, nope. We promise to be straight with each other. Tell me the truth. What's holding you back? No, I don't have the money. Fine. Explore that and see if you can solve it. If you can't, end the conversation. There's no shame in not being able to close every sale. If you can close every sale, you're a checker in a grocery store.
No, these days you have to go to the self-checkout, which I still won't do.
I've never been to one, never
I
will go to
either.
one. No.
I will not. It's not my job. I'm not going to do it. Ben, I've been thinking while you were talking, and we are going to run out of time in about 5 minutes, but you have had just amazingly gifted and caring mentors. And you
I
remember
have been.
all of them, and you say thank you to all of them. Every time we talk, you're mentioning somebody 50, 60 years back that was just such a huge influence on you, straight. And Zig Ziglar, which, you know, I think you hired him at some point, but you have been genuinely blessed with the people around you. There's no question.
True. But the blessing was not accidental. Part of many of the people I knew from that era who are all legends now was because I was sitting in the catbird seat. Jimmy Rucker and I beat Zig Ziglar and Mel Lanius in a year-long sales contest, and the surprise prize was I was made president of the company. Rucker decided to stay in Atlanta, so he didn't make the journey, but I was made president of the company. We were the largest MLM direct sales company on earth at the time. We were what's happening. And if you were a speaker or a promoter and you wanted to jump to the big time quickly, you wanted to get in front of a Holiday Magic or Stay Power or Bob Cummings Vitamins. We had five companies all with the same marketing plan, but five different companies. You wanted to get in front of one of our international conventions. You wanted to be in that group. So at 25, I guess I was when I became president, I'm sitting in the catbird seat, and here they come through the door, Ogmandino and Zig Ziglar. And Zig, I knew from Atlanta, we joined the same business on the same day. Napoleon Hill was brought to me, Earl Nightingale, I knew of, but I'd never met him, wanted to work with us, became the voice of Holiday Magic, Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, you know, I can go down the list. These were just regular people. Somebody asked me one day, how did you meet Ogmandino? I said, I think I was going to the men's room. Meaning I walked out of my office into the main hallway, and there were, at any given time in the building, 10 or 15 people whose names you know today. They were just wandering around our building trying to get hired. And so that was part of it. And the other part of it was I go looking. If I go into a situation, restaurant, party, business meeting, whatever, if there's somebody unique, unusual, standout-ish in that group, I will zoom in on them, meet them, and we will become friends, unless I discover something that about them that turns me off, in which case I'm capable of just drifting away and making no eye contact anymore. And that's how you wind up as the attitude coach for the Apollo astronauts on 15, 16, 17. It's how Dr. Norman Vincent Peale becomes your good friend, and how Sally Stanford, the madam of San Francisco, become good friends. I would love to just glance at a list I have of people when you brought that up. And I think I'd really like to get all these people together at one time. It's not possible now with a lot of them, at one time in one place. And the common denominator between all of them is me. But just let them get to know, you know, hi, Miss Stanford, what do you do for a living? Oh, well, I'm a prostitute. Oh, and what do you do? Well, I'm a minister at the largest church in New York City. I'm Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. They would have loved each other. I promise you, I found things to love in all of them, but I went looking for them. I've made it my life's goal. It's how you wind up sitting in Charlie Manson's cell at San Quentin for 9 hours, chatting three different visits, but sitting with him for 9 hours. And there, and I told you this before, he had one book in his cell, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Even Charlie and I had a link.
See, and I find that amazing. And listen, when you get to heaven, throw a big old party because you're going to meet them all. And then when I get up there, I want to be part of that party. So I'm just, do not leave me off the invite.
Of most of them, the only one I hope isn't there is Charlie Manson.
Charlie Manson. Yeah, I don't want to meet him either. Yeah, I would
There's,
not.
Even if they had a little flaw here and there, as do I. So you'll meet everybody but Charlie Manson.
Okay, I'll go then. And I'll wear my best dress and my highest heels. So, listen, we are running out of time. What do we want to talk about? I love these chats every Wednesday. And, you know, I walk away from these just going, oh, there's always something new. I mean, you and I have talked about straight in almost every conversation we've had because it's that important. But every time, you know, I sit back and I think, what did we talk about? And I go back and I listen to it and I read the notes and the transcript and I'm like, and I'm taking notes because fourth wall. Oh, I missed that part. Oh, okay. There we go. Thank you for your wisdom. I mean, well, I genuinely appreciate these Wednesdays with you.
Well, I really appreciate it. You know, it's hard to be a prophet in your own hometown. So you and your listeners are somebody I can tell the stories to because my family and immediate friends have heard them all.
So now it's, I know why you're here. Okay.
Yeah, it's Wednesday. I get to tell old stories.
Well, you do, and you get to tell them to a very grateful world. So we covered straight. The next one, I guess we should go to page 249, cut cancellations.
Yeah, let's pick up there.
249. I got it written down. Okay, Ben, tell people where they can find you, your mentoring program. I think you said last week that you were full But let them know. And then, of course, the sales, Bibles, the closers.
Well, for the men, can
sorry.
You hear me?
Yeah,
Can
I
you?
can hear you now.
Okay, I'll give you that. It's
Okay, give me all that.
stores, stores dot ebay dot com / Ronzoni Books, all one word, Ronzone Books, Books. Special pricing, free shipping, etc. And I was just going to give my email for mentoring or to be in contact with me. Just email BFG3, short for Benjamin Franklin Gay III, at directcon, directcon.net. And put something in the if you want to get on the waiting list for mentoring, just put mentoring on the subject line. Anything else? Tell me what's on your mind.
And ask us questions. Listen, I'm easy to find online. I'm distressingly easy to find online. And you're welcome to contact me directly toll free at 888-719-6711. 888-719-6711. Be sure to leave a message and I will return your call probably that day. If it's the call is late, it'll be the next day, but within 24 hours, very definitely. And you can also email me at support@yourofficeontheweb.com. And we love to hear from you. So send us questions. We want to read them and answer them. And thank you everyone for joining us. And be sure to find us on your partner in Success Radio. Just look for your names, our names rather, and or the Closers Inner Circle Podcast. Truly, you can't throw a stick on the internet without hitting either one of us. Ben, thank you. I will see you next week.
See you then.